Welcome to the New England Authors Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Stone. This program is brought to you in cooperation with the Day Publishing Group and its sponsors. In this episode, we're speaking with Connecticut author Alexander Brash, whose new book, A Whaler at Twilight, was co-authored by his great-great-grandfather, Robert W. Armstrong. How that collaboration came to be and the remarkable story he tells has been earning praise from critics and readers alike. It is published by Lions Press and is available at local bookstores everywhere, as well as from online booksellers such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Alex, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Richard, it's a pleasure to be here on your author's podcast. I so look forward to it. And I would note for the viewers, one of the great things is I actually interned for the day, in the day. I was a Connecticut college student. And after interning for a semester at the day, I then went on and became the manager of the college newspaper. So I think it's a wonderful wraparound.
This is great. It's kind of like full circle. So tell me about this story and how it is that you and your great-great-grandfather came to meet one another.
Well, it's a long and convoluted and occasionally a rather guilt-ridden story. But I think it successfully worked at last. When I was a young lad, I became interested in birds. And one of my first jobs was at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And I sort of worked my way through both high school and college in the ornithology department there, moving bird trays and stuff around. And along the way, I would skip out for lunch and with my sandwich go and enjoy the beautiful dioramas throughout the museum. And my favorite was always the pelagic seabirds. So somewhere after that, I kept going along in the bird world. And as an ornithologist, then ended up in grad school. And one of the gigs that I did then was to take people on trips. And at one point, I partnered up with another grad student at a University of Rhode Island who knew marine mammals. And together, he and I led a trip off out of Provincetown to go and see the whales and birds off Stellwagen Bank. And up there, really for the first time on this trip, I came face to face with some just incredibly beautiful, thoughtful, if you will, whales, both humpbacks and right whales. And we had several times when they welled up from the deep and just appeared at the side of the boat. And you could, it evoked a great compassion in me and a much deeper appreciation of their intelligence. So at the end of the trip, I came back and I picked up the phone and I called my parents. I said, wow, I was just on this really cool trip. And I came face to face with a whale and they're absolutely amazing. And my mother, without missing a beat, turned and said, well, you know, you have a whaler in your background. I said, what? And she said, well, there's a whaler. You have a great, great grandfather who's a whaler. And there's even a map or something. And I said, oh, that's really great and cool. And, you know, remind me to look at it. And of course, way goes to way and path leads on to path, kind of in a Robert Frost way. And it was many years before I got back. I kept working and, you know, raised a family and so forth. And finally, when I had some time, having been a conservationist for nigh on 30, 40 years, and luckily for me, my mother at 97, still alive. And I went back to her at the time. This is now about 5 years ago. And I said, so, Mom, what is this whaler story? And so she beckoned me and I went back into her bedroom closet. And there underneath this dresses and coats and all that stuff was this big black leather trunk with brass hinges. And she said, pull it out. So we pulled it out and on the top were her dancing shoes from the 1930s or something. And the next layer down had my grandfather's surveying equipment from when he was drafted in World War I and ended up being a map maker. And then way at the bottom were some few old scuffy books and a couple of piles of papers. And so she pointed at one and I pulled it out and it was a, you know, Xeroxed copy of this 100-page handwritten manuscript. So I took it and I went home and then I spent the next 2 or 3 weeks sitting on my front porch in the morning with a cup of coffee in hand trying to digitize. So I read the whole thing onto a laptop or tried. And I have to confess that after about a week of it, I was actually deeply chagrined because the Xerox was so poor, I couldn't read it. And I then was sort of, in a way, closing the loop, much like my ancestor before, but I was almost too embarrassed to go back. And I finally went back to my mother, though, after about 2 weeks. I said, "Mom, this is, you know, I'm really sorry to say, I sort of feel guilty. If I'd reached out, done this 30 years ago, maybe it would have been clearer." I mean, of course not, it wouldn't have, but I thought that way. And she said, well, look over here. And so on the other side of the trunk was a beautiful, looked like a mimeograph. It was white writing on a black background, an early kind of mimeograph in the 1930s. And it was a copy her father had made. And so I pulled that out and it was clear as a bell. Wow. And I could sit down and digitize the whole thing. And then I became fascinated. It was an incredible story. I mean, he wrote a crazy, rollicking, two-life tale, and it sort of just totally enthralled me. And then I spent the next 3 years really doing contextual background research. And luckily, as a grad student at the Yale School of Environment, as an alumnus, they gave me access to STORES, which is a great online research source. And between that and, you know, simply going on Google and so forth, you know, I tracked down all these parallel stories, the various places that he went, the various ships that he met with, and sort of looked for whatever I could find. And out of that, I mean, there were numerous parallel tales that intersected, but I picked what were the clearly ones he was either most involved in or the most intriguing. You know, and in one case, I found an 1830s rewrite from the other perspective on one of the mutinies that he was involved in. Yeah. So it was completely fascinating and better yet, corroborating.
Yeah.
And
so as I read this book, you know, and probably the beginning of his story, when you, you know, you do the introduction, kind of explaining what whaling is about. And then we get into his journal. And as I read it, I thought of Moby Dick. I thought of Nathaniel Philbrick's The Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. His description of when he first went out to sea, having to climb the top of the mast to take in the sails in a storm, and then all the subsequent things. How does your story differ? Because it, I knew it drew me in the same way those books draw people. Moby Dick and Heart of the Sea.
I think it, I mean, to your point, I think it fits right in the sense that I always considered, I think it's one of the greatest, it's a great nonfiction companion to Moby Dick. Herman Melville himself sailed only 10 years before and was in the same waters in the same places and encountered a lot of the same events, if you will, or parallel events. And Philbrick's book captures the horrific story of a bunch of whalers who were on one of the two ships that actually got sunk. I would say that the bigger differences are, you know, one, his story, unlike Moby Dick, is in fact nonfiction. It's a real life story, much as the story of the Essex is. And the Essex is sort of less about the larger contextual background, less about whaling per se, and less about you know, what was going on in the South Pacific, less about the initial first contact that many of these whalers had with indigenous peoples, and more about, you know, the horror and the story of the crews who are stuck on the little whaleboats and they're trying to cross 2,000 miles back.
Yeah.
Ironically, one element of this story is Robert Armstrong, my great-great-grandfather, who's the protagonist in the story, but and my co-author, several of the crew members of his ship were from the Anne Alexander, which was the only other whale ship like the Essex to actually be sunk by a whale.
Oh.
His crew members had been on that ship for two voyages. They left the Anne Alexander, and they, just because the timing was right when they were switching ships in New Bedford, and they jumped on the ship with my ancestor, and sure enough, the next voyage of the Anne Alexander went out, and that's the one that got sunk by the whale, as did the Essex.
Yes. Well, I think the readers, the people listening, are going to have to go get the book to discover what happened. It's a fabulous story. And you, as a historian, writer, and also as a conservationist, how did this story affect you in terms of how the world viewed conservation, whales, things of that nature, a century ago, a century and a half ago, versus now?
I mean, digging through my ancestors' story, and then also having come at it 150 years later with a very different probably ethos in life, as well as being a conservationist, there are a couple things that jumped out at me. One was his journey is in a unique part of American history, not often explored. It's really during the American expansionism. The founding fathers have now passed. Andrew Jackson was recently president and sort of led the, 40 acres and a mule, let's cross the Pacific, let's cross the American West and take over as much territory as we can from the other nations. But on top of that, they were doing something similar across the Pacific, and they're doing it with a heavy hand.
Yes.
And he sails, my great grandfather sails in the wake of that. And a lot of their interactions with the islanders, indigenous islanders, are reflective of that happening.
Yes.
Also, he had an incredibly different life, and it brought out a lot of pathos in me in regards to him. I mean, his parents died when he was early. He struggled with alcohol, substance abuse, which so many people do even today, of course, and how he dealt with it is unique, and luckily he did finally.
Yes. No, I think it's a very timely story. I think I was surprised by how contemporary the story is, and yet how revealing it is about that portion of history. It struck me as that you discover this in your closet, almost thinking, yeah, as you were saying it a few moments ago, I thought you're going to find these maps. It'll be a treasure map. As it prompted other people that you've met, as you tell this story, they say, well, I've had a similar experience, or I'm going to go home now and look. I mean, great aunt mentioned something. Any comments that you got from people that have read it?
There's been a lot of that. Almost everybody who has read the book, and when I've then gone to an event as an author, to read it or whatever, have come out, and you're absolutely dead on. That's one of the things that it really evokes out of people. It's just to go back and reconsider. I mean, the elements of that are both. It's an incredible. For me, it was incredibly deep and telling to be able to go back and sort of reconnect. Five generations back and try to understand someone. But also in the same point, I also, went and traveled. I went to Baltimore to connect, and I went on a couple of other trips down around Cape Horn to try to connect, and even as far as New Zealand, where he logged for 4.5 years. And I, at the end of that, I felt an incredible connection in many ways, and also differences. I mean, our outlooks are very different. But lots of people have come up to me and said, I've gone back and I've talked to my mother, I've checked things, I've gone online, I've gone on ancestry.com, and it's brought that out, I think, in a lot of people to go back and sort of look at one's past and appreciate it, and sometimes also be happy about the differences.
Yes, the that voyage that you took when you went when you were retracing his steps, that was particularly interesting. And the photos in your book, I think they alone are worth picking up the book. The ancient one and some of the current ones that you have of whaling and how that has changed so much.
The ancient ones, I have to thank a good friend of mine, Vicky Gall, and she used to work for Ken Burns. And so when I said I was putting this book together and I was looking, she said, I know the archive. So she dug out what are probably the first actual photographs of whaling in process. And so those are in there. And then, yes, some of the others, there's a handful of mine in there, the various seabirds, because as we touched on a little bit before, but I was a conservationist and I love the diorama, so I did it at 2 points go, and as I say, follow in his path, and I sailed around Cape Horn, and then I sailed off the islands of New Zealand, and my goal in both of them was not only to sort of to feel the ocean and seas as he saw them, but also to take the opportunity to pusue my love of the beautiful pelagic seabirds, the ashy mantled sooty albatrosses, and all the numerous other great seabirds and albatross families, and the fulmars and so forth. And so, you know, it was an incredible opportunity to do that. And it also, you know, brought back to me how fragile our seas are and how much currently marine mammals as well as seabirds need greater conservation efforts. You know.
Well, thank you. I applaud your work in that area and also writing this book. And again, being able to co-author something with a great, great grandparent, that alone is pretty remarkable. I'm not sure I've ever run across that sort of co-authoring before. And I'm sure many people have commented on that as well.
Great. Mark, I call it our duet autobiography. And thank you. Thank you, Dick. Cool. It's been a great pleasure to be on the podcast.
Yes, Alex, thank you. And we look forward to speaking to you again, particularly if you write another book.
Working on it now.
Excellent. Well, can you give us a preview?
I'm working on actually the natural history of Far Island National Seashore. It's sort of a somewhat like something like The Outermost House or, you know, Thoreau on Walden Pond or something like that, sort of a year in the life of. But it's a fragile barrier island and of great beauty, and it's been a national park since 1965.
Wonderful. We are going to come back and speak to you again about that. Anyway, people, you have been listening to the New England Authors Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Stone, and we recommend this book. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.